This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Monster marriage. The icy threats we are learning a vascular surgeon husband made years before, nearly 10 years before, he allegedly shoots his ex-wife and new dentist husband dead in their own beds, their children wailing in the background. Now think about it. How long did those bodies lie there going cold in pools of blood with their children sitting there with mommy and daddy dead? I'm Nancy Grace. This is Crime Stories. I want to thank you for being with us. Stone-faced and cold-blooded, a surgeon in court after his ex-wife and her dentist husband both shot dead. He knows exactly what's happening and not a flicker of emotion on his face. Not one ounce, not one drop, one scintilla of remorse. How long did he stalk her? As he gets kicked from one jurisdiction to the next, multiple malpractice and claims against him, he looks at her online. She moved on in a big way. She found true love, gets married to an awesome guy. They have two children. They get married in their home. They post a video of it, and there he is, alone. Alone and miserable. Now we are learning that she, quote, just had to get out of that starter marriage. It was just for 7 months. It was nearly 10 years ago. And he brewed and bubbled and simmered and stewed for nearly 10 years till he makes an over 300-mile trek to shoot her dead in bed with her husband, her children in the room next door. This is what we've learned. Listen.
She was terrified because he had threatened her life on multiple occasions when they were married. She wasn't shy about talking to people about traumatic experiences that she had with her ex and just how emotionally abusive he was to her.
That's from our friends at NBC. I'm going to analyze what we are hearing straight out to investigative reporter Susan Hendricks, also an author of Down the Hill, My Descent into the Double Murder in Delphi. Susan, on this case from the very beginning. Susan, that is the brother-in-law speaking out. Quote, she was terrified because he had threatened her life on multiple occasions when they were married. That's nearly 10 years ago. She would talk openly to family members. What do you make of it?
I believe, as he said, that she was terrified. And how do I know? Because her social media was private. She was very much kind of on the down low on social media, if you will. I don't think she wanted to make her ex angry. I think because the brother-in-law also said it changed her as a person. He was that emotionally abusive. I think it went on beyond the marriage. I think she was fearful of him, clearly. And I think that's why Spencer's dental office knew that something was off that day.
If any of us had known that these threats were actually grounded in possibility, we all would have acted differently. Myself and many others were well aware of kind of the negative impact that he had on her. She was willing to do anything to get out of there.
From our friends at NBC and GMA, that is the brother-in-law, Rob Missler, speaking out. Woulda, coulda, shoulda. You know what? All survivors do that. Isn't that true, Dr. Bethany Marshall? If only we had known, if actually we had known they were grounded in reality, we would have done things differently. But people don't live their lives thinking, oh, he's going to drive 6 hours and shoot them in their beds. There's no reason they should have known that he was secretly stalking his ex-wife all these years, Bethany.
The family perhaps shouldn't have known, but I believe Monique knew. If her social media was private, if she talked about the abuse. And Nancy, this escalated in just 7 months of marriage. You know, stalking behavior can start just after one date. The guy falls in love with you and then believes there's a special relationship when there's none. The girl doesn't return the text or the phone call, and now he's enraged. And so When women leave a relationship, they're at the highest risk for domestic homicide. As you pointed out, she left. She had moved on. And that very act enraged him. And he punished her for this perceived rejection. That's what he did. He mowed her down, but I think she knew.
Deep down inside, or do you think she saw him, or she got a weird text or an email, and she goes, oh my stars, that's McKee. Or do you think it was just a gut feeling in her bones she knew?
I think it was a gut feeling. I treat women who are stalking victims, and often they fall into a depression. They're in a dysphoric state, and they become preoccupied with the offender. They think about them all the time. They look at their, out their car windows. They're sitting in a restaurant with a new partner, and they see, like, say, Nicole Brown. They see a car drive by, like a white Tahoe, and they think, oh my God, is that my ex-husband? So they live in fear. Nancy, it gets into their brains. I bet it was in her brain, in her thought process, that she was at risk. It was always there, and that's why she was talking about it.
As we go to air tonight, extradition delayed. What's going on? Is he some sort of a security threat? Why can't we get him to home turf to get this trial ball rolling, get the show on the road? At this time, we know the state is building its case against vascular surgeon Dr. McKee. Just think about this guy. He excelled in everything he did. That's his mugshot. He excelled in everything. He played football on a very high level in college. He was Dean's List honor student in undergrad. He was a star student in medical school. He went on to become a vascular surgeon certified to practice in multiple jurisdictions. Just before the two, Monique and her husband, are shot dead, he gets sacked with a malpractice suit, a pretty serious one, and another claim that one patient actually lost his testicle because of McKee. Very serious complaints, and then he ghosts everybody. He leaves that jurisdiction and disappears to where even a PI can't find him and just starts all over again in another jurisdiction. Could he move that surreptitiously? Which leads me to, how long had he been surreptitiously stalking Monique? There she is, Monique, and the first starter husband, Michael McKee, the vascular surgeon, straight out to a real pro. Joining us tonight, Randy Kessler. You know him well. He is a veteran trial lawyer, Emory Law School professor, former chair of the ABA Family Law Section, the American Bar Association, author of Divorced, Protect Yourself, Your Kids, and Your Future. Randy Kessler, you and I have crossed swords many, many times in court. Kessler, think about it. Now, I know you would never bring this up in court about your own client, right? But this guy's not your client. Tell me the truth. How long do you think he had been stalking her in person, maybe even watching them put the code into the keypad and goes, oh, that's her father's birthday? Or online, watching that wedding video over and over and over. And there he is sitting alone having his TV dinner, looking at her video and her happy life. How long you think he's been stalking Monique?
It's one of two dates. It's either the date that the final divorce was granted or the date that the divorce was filed. This was his first rejection from what we can tell, right? Like you said, he was so successful in everything. I mean, the pinnacle, a vascular surgeon, a football star, Dean's List, married to a beautiful woman. And then she rejects him or it doesn't work. And that's, you know, that's what divorce is about. People feel like somebody who I thought was the perfect person, who I wanted to be with forever, tells me I'm not good enough. They're rejecting me. That may not be the truth of the matter, but that could easily be the perception. That might have started, it might have been when he started stalking her. It might have been when it started the trigger for him thinking, how do I rectify this? He obviously couldn't handle it if this is the guy who did it. And I think that's when it started, if you ask me, which you did.
All those years, Kessler. So you think he started stalking behavior all the way back to the time that she left him. And did you know, Kessler, that she, on her little money that she was making, very educated, I believe she had a master's degree, not making a lot of money, But the little bit she made, she paid a private judge to expedite the divorce proceedings.
Because putting
it in the docket, just think about where you practice, Fulton Superior. You can wait a year before you can get a divorce on a docket and be heard, you know, actually get a jury trial or a hearing. She paid herself alone to expedite that divorce. And guess what he wanted? I hope you're sitting down. You need to lay down because I happen to know you've got a big, beautiful brocade sofa, a plush sofa in your fancy digs at your office. So you may need to lay down on that, Kessler. He asked, demanded that she pay him back for the engagement ring and the wedding band. And then he charged her 23% interest on a $1,200 miscellaneous debt he claimed she owed him. Okay. No wonder she left him.
You know, there's a horrible joke about why is the divorce so expensive? Because it's worth it. It was worth it to her. You know, we have our rich clients pay for private judges all the time to do it privately, to expedite it, to do it at their own schedule. But yes, sometimes people just want out. And a lot of people were commenting in the press and in the news that it was an uncontested, it was an amicable divorce. It was amicable just in that it wasn't fought out in court. And that's because somebody, obviously her now, wanted out. She even agreed to pay her own lawyer fees. When you have a surgeon on one side, usually the person making all the money is required to pay both sides' attorney's fees because it's a marital expense. That's marital income. She obviously clearly wanted out. And, you know, when did she ever feel safe? And that's a sad
thing. Hey, look at that picture, Kessler. Do you see that picture right there that I'm showing of her pregnant in front of the Christmas tree? How crazy do you think that made that vascular surgeon ex-husband? There she is pregnant by another man, which, of course, you know what that means. They had to have sex. I bet that drove him right over the edge, Kessler.
Yeah, but when do you ever feel safe? And that's what tears at me, not just what happened, but all these women out there that have gotten away from somebody like that. She's moved on. She's got children. She's married. She's living in another state. When is enough? When can you look in the rearview mirror and say, there's nothing there. It's just shadows. And you see cases like this, and there are a lot of people having post-traumatic stress disorder just from this story, I'm sure. We see women that come back to us and they say, I still need a restraining order. I said, but you're divorced. Yes, but he's still calling. But he's still coming by. Just a terrible situation. And unfortunately, I don't think this is the only person out there that got this concern.
On December 30th, 2025, at approximately 10:04 a.m., Columbus Police Patrol officers were dispatched to the 1400 block of North 4th Street on a well-being check. Officers arrived at the scene and located the two adult victims suffering from apparent gunshot wounds. We now know that they were identified as Mr. Spencer Tepe and Mrs. Monique Tepe. Their two small children were also found in the residence, physically unharmed.
Straight out to special guest joining us, Dr. Thomas Coyne, Chief Medical Examiner, District 2 Medical Examiner's Office, State of Florida. He is a forensic pathologist, toxicologist, neuropathologist. Dr. Coyne, thank you for being with us. I want to address what the two children have been through. Guys, I'm going to get to the news as quickly as I can about the fact that his extradition has been delayed. What does it mean? Don't worry. He's not burning up the interstate, the Ohio Turnpike, to get back home because Ohio does have the death penalty. It was hanging. Then it went to old Sparky, the electric chair. Now it's needle, death by lethal injection. There's a moratorium on right now on the death penalty, but it's not official. It's unofficial. They can't get the correct drugs to perform death by needle. But who knows? Maybe they'll go back to death by firing squad, like other jurisdictions have done. Or possibly some sort of nitrous oxide. That's on the table as well. That's a whole nother can of worms. Dr. Thomas Coyne, I want to talk to you about the two children. They're both under 4 years old. They were heard in the background. If I could get the control room to pull up the 911 call where you can hear the children screaming, wailing in the background. Dr. Coyne, what would the children have seen? Because we know that the husband was shot twice. Monique was shot once. And they have placed the shootings after 3 a.m. and cops didn't break in. Well, actually, friends had to get in the home until hours and hours later, well after 9 a.m. Would the blood have coagulated? Would the bodies have gotten cold? Because I believe the children were in there with their parents' dead bodies.
Horrible, horrible. Yeah, I mean, number one, just coming upon the bodies, and depending upon where they were shot, but there would have been a considerable amount of bleeding, especially even from a head wound or a wound to the chest. And so their clothing may have been soaked in blood. Where they were lying, for instance, if they were in a bedroom, the bed sheets may have been soaked in blood. And depending upon where they were shot, you know, if it was an angled shot that sort of hit the head, there could have been a tearing of the scalp tissue. So it could have been quite horrific and gruesome for the children to see their parents in that state.
Tell me about what you would expect to see around a scene where the husband had been shot twice in the chest with a 9mm and the wife shot once, we also believe, in the chest. Would there have been, well, we also know another fact. When the friend came in and saw the dentist's dead body, he said he was half on, half off the bed or beside the bed. Would that blood have already coagulated in, say, 6 hours? Would the bodies already be cold? It's freezing cold outside and snowing, but the ambient temperature in the room, probably 68, 69, or 70.
The bodies would have started, I mean, had they been shot hours prior, the body temperature would have started to acclimate towards that of the home. And they certainly would have probably still had some rigor present in the body, a little stiff. The blood would have settled.
Slow down, Dr. Coyne. Rigor.
Sure,
you
sure.
mean when the children come upon their mom and they try to touch her, hold her, she's already in rigor mortis.
Yes. So her body would have been stiff, cold, and probably stiff to touch. Her arms and her legs may have been rigid. And there probably was also labrum mortis, which is the settling of the blood based upon gravity. So you'll see pinkish or purple discoloration of the body on the bottom where it's lying. And so they probably would have encountered that upon seeing the two victims. The blood also, would have started to coagulate. If it sits for quite a long period of time, you can also see separation of the cellular component from the liquid component. So we call it serum. So you may see a little separation of that as well. But if it's soaked into the bed sheets, it would have just looked all red.
Just thinking about what those children saw and experienced. When you say both mom and dad would be in full rigor, unless you've seen it, it's hard to explain. The only way I've explained it to a jury is that, you know, a 2x4, right? You've been around lumber, right, doctor?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
It's just like that. If you try to touch the mom, her arm is like a 2x4. It's that hard. It's that stiff.
That stiff, and you can't bend it. You know, it's almost immobile. And so for the child who's going up to their parents hoping to feel a warm body, it would probably feel horrible. I mean, just cold and very stiff, non-responsive.
You know, Dr. Bethany, I don't know how a child, you know, two children under the age of 4, what they thought they were seeing. But I can tell you this, I don't care what all the shrinks say, children remember long before 3 years old. I have memories as early as 2 years old that I can identify. I think my daughter has memories before that. How will they remember that? Will they suppress it? Will it come back in dreams? Will it affect their personalities for the rest of their lives?
It'll come back in so many forms, Nancy. It could come back, as I've said before, at a preconscious, pre-verbal level, meaning they have the sensation of seeing a traumatic scene, but they can't really put it into words. They could be walking down the street someday and see somebody walk in front of a car and have a flashback and think, oh my God, that car is going to hit that person. They could become people who refuse to form attachments because this premature loss of the parent makes them too terrified of abandonment. It's going to affect them on all levels. Nancy, it could predispose them to personality disorders, to drug abuse, to alcoholism. This will have a traumatic effect. The best thing that can happen for these children is to go into a new family where there are predictable and safe attachment systems, so they can
They're with their relatives now, Dr. Bethany.
That's good.
The two children
they need
are
to be with
relatives.
Their relatives.
I think the dog is a golden doodle, and it is also with the children.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Hey, Dr. Coyne, let me ask you a question. I was thinking about what the children would have experienced. And I was out jogging the other night, and I smelled a smell. And it immediately made me think of my grandmother, Lucy, that helped raise me. It was kind of a fresh, like a cucumber, not quite a cucumber, but something like that. And I don't know what it is. I've tried to identify when I do smell it, where is that coming from? It must be some kind of a plant. But I immediately think of her because she smelled that kind of a fresh smell. Dr. Coyne, why does blood smell?
You know, some people say it's got a metallic smell to it, almost like iron. It's biological, so there are a number of different biological compounds that we produce that may be present in blood at any given time. You know, from ammonia type, chemicals, just to the, mineral component of the blood as well. So, but there is a definite unique smell to blood. It doesn't vaporize, let's say, like human tissue as our fatty tissue begins to break down. It aromatizes this sort of putrid chemical smell that is quite unique, you know, human death compared to animal death. But blood does have a pretty unique smell that I think most of us can recognize.
Kessler, I know that you specialize in domestic relations. That's certainly putting perfume on the pig. Divorce, nasty divorce, the worst divorce, the most expensive divorce. You got to get Kessler. But you have also handled criminal cases. Have you ever been on a murder scene?
No, I've never had the misfortune to go. And I'm glad. We bring in criminal.
Well, I'm glad because that smell is something you never forget. The smell of a decomposing body or the smell of blood coagulating. I'm glad. I'm happy for you. But okay, since that's a no from you, let me go to Bethany. Bethany, just like the other night when I was jogging and I smell that fresh plant smell, I thought of my grandmother. I was thinking about something completely different. And then I'm just thinking about these children going through life. And then they smell a smell. And it smells like, oh, here's another one. I can't stand to smell chrysanthemums. Because when I walked into my fiance's funeral, it was like it hit me in the face. I hate that smell. I'm just wondering, there's just so many things that affect these children's memory. It can be a smell. It can be a moment. It can be a feeling. It can be anything that's going to trigger this for them the rest of their lives.
Nancy, it's called evocative memory. Let's say you go on a trip and you take a certain kind of perfume or product on the trip, and then years later you pull that product out of a drawer and you smell it, you will think about that trip. So anything those children saw, smelled, felt in that room, it's going to be evoked. So let's say they see the color red. Let's say they're watching a movie. And we know that there is violence in all movies, unless it's a comedy. They will see maybe the sight of blood or somebody being killed or a child looking at a parent. That evocative memory is going to be triggered. And then you combine that with PTSD, one of the symptoms of which is flashbacks. A flashback is when you're in a similar situation to the earlier trauma and your brain tells you that you're in the exact same situation again. Let's say you're in the war, you are in the middle of an explosion, an IED goes off. Years later, you're walking down the street and a car backfires. All of a sudden, you feel you're in the war again. So these kids are going to be exposed to similar flashbacks and evocative memory throughout the rest of their lives.
What's changed since the last person I talked to?
There's a body.
There's a body inside?
Yeah.
Okay, hold on 1 second. Let me get you on the line with the medic, okay? Stay on the line.
He appears dead.
Multiple weapons were taken from the property of McKee. And there is a preliminary link from our NIBIN to one of the weapons that ties it to the homicides.
Local and Columbus police in and out of McKee's 12th floor Chicago apartment with boxes of potential evidence, lugging it down to a Columbus PD crime lab van in the underground garage. Residents receive a notice authorities will be investigating over several days, and they shouldn't be concerned by the officer posted outside McKee's door. Preliminary testing leads them to believe one of those weapons is connected to the Tepe's murders.
Did you find any other evidence in his home in Lincoln Park?
What I can tell you is that we did search his property and we have evidence, but I can't speak to any specific evidence.
They've got evidence. They were observed lugging box after box after box out of vascular surgeon Dr. McKee's penthouse apartment there at Lincoln Park. Straight out to a special guest joining us tonight, Koa Lorimore, thank you for being with us. Former Army sniper, sharpshooter. I want to talk to you about the weapons. You just heard Columbus Police Chief Elaine Bryant state that there is a preliminary match from evidence found in the home, i.e. the gun. I don't know where they found it, in the home, in the car. Doesn't matter for your purposes. But they've got a match to the bullets fired at the scene. Were they lodged in the body? Did they ricochet off the wall? Were they stuck in the wall? Were they stuck in the mattress? Were they stuck in the floor? Doesn't matter. They're saying they've got a match. Now, before I get to you about how that match is deduced, I want to talk to you about how difficult would it be for the killer to engrave or write on the bullets. Now, you see, I didn't think about that before the devil kicked Luigi Mangione into my life, who wrote, let's see, deny, delay, depose. He actually took the time to write that on the bullets that he used to shoot the UnitedHealthcare boss, according to police. Then you've got the fiend that shot Charlie Kirk, Tyler Robinson. He wrote, hey, fascist, on the bullet. Okay, they've got way too much spare time, but that's for a shrink. Koa Lorimore, tell me, how would you write something on the bullet?
Well, Nancy, you could take a Dremel tool and then you take the casing of the bullet like I have right here, and you could basically just engrave whatever you want on that casing. But I think you would have to have a special kind of hatred to go to the lengths of engraving something on that.
Agree. Now, let me ask you this, Koa. What if we learn the defendant, the surgeon, Dr. McKee, created his own ammunition? Yes, people actually do that. How do you create your own ammunition? And to me, and I'm going to get to Kessler on this, that would leave a trail a mile wide if you created your own bullets. How do you do that?
So you need a special machine that they use to create a bullet like this. And then you take all the components. You take the primer on the back, the casing, obviously the gunpowder inside, and then the bullet, and you press it all together. This is common practice with like precision shooters, people that do it for sport. Pretty uncommon just for your average guy.
Okay, there is actually a machine that does it. It's a manual swagging process. And, you know, the reason I'm asking about this, hold on, Koa Lorimore, to Dr. Bethany Marshall, a psychoanalyst joining us out of L.A., at drbethanymarshall.com. Dr. Bethany, he spent practically 10 years, 8 years plus, thinking about her. And something pushed him over the edge. It could have been these lawsuits where one guy lost a testicle and the other had a shard of a catheter stuck in his leg, which caused, according to him, disfigurement. And then when they tried to sue surgeon Dr. McKee, he ghosted everyone and vanished. Even the process server couldn't find him. And, you know, they make money when they finally serve you the papers. So he was trying to find him, and he totally disappeared. That said, that could have triggered it. But all these years, he has been watching her. And I could just see him hunched over a table with one of these machines, making his own bullets and engraving them out of hatred.
You know, Nancy, almost 50% of all stalking happens during the course of a marriage, not necessarily afterwards. So this stalking behavior probably started from the first date, first of all. Secondly, there's going to be a lot of behavioral evidence. He probably made many attempts to contact her. So there's going to be emails, letters, snail mail. I think we're going to find all sorts of things. And in terms of the risk factors for violence, why now? What pushed him over the edge? Usually a demotion in stature and rejection. So the fact that he was potentially had a lawsuit against him made him feel humiliated.
At risk of Randy Kelser objection, claiming asked and answered. I always love that objection at trial. But let me, instead of asking the same thing, Dr. Bethany, refine my question. Let me refine my question. In other words, ask it in another way. Dr. Bethany, you know how stalkers and freaks, they get enjoyment from the process of the stalking. I think it makes them feel closer to the target, their victim. Mm-hmm. Like writing them letters. They take great pains to write the letter and then sneak up and leave it there or mail it. They get some enjoyment from that. So what would he have derived from making his own bullets if he did with the die set? What joy would he get from that?
Well, think about kill kits. When serial killers assemble the kit in preparation for finding victims, the enjoyment he would have gotten is complete and utter power over her, looking at the fear in her eyes, blotting her off the face of the earth so he doesn't have to think about her anymore, potentially killing her husband in front of her while she's still alive so he shows her who's really the boss in this situation. And I think more importantly, a reversal of power. He imagines she has power over him because she's moved on, but he's going to try to assert power over her, reverse power dynamic. In my field, we call it triumphing over the love object. He's triumphing over her every time he engraves that bullet.
Dr. Bethany, I'm going back to Coalormore right now with bullet questions. But I want you to think about something. You know how people, when they're dating, they get ready for the date? Like the woman does her hair, puts on makeup, the man will go wash the car, this is stereotypical, of course, and gets all ready, maybe buys flowers. It's all in anticipation of those few hours that they have a date. Just imagine him getting the bullets, getting the gun, driving all the way down the Ohio Turnpike, going through the, 24 tolls to get there. All in anticipation of the moment he pulls the trigger and sees her face and her fear. I want to talk about that process. Coalormore joining us. Okay, so we've talked about the die set. It's the machine that is used to create your own bullets. And if he did create his own bullets, there's going to be evidence. There's going to be a die set. There's going to be the material needed to make the bullet, the outside, the inside. The process requires a lot of, let me just say, material. But how do you make the comparison? Explain to me how, just like that, that police chief knows we've got a preliminary match.
So there's telltale signs on the casing itself. If left at the scene, that can be traced back to the weapon. So first, you're going to have a primer strike where the bullet is fired right on the primer. Then you're going to have scratches on the casing that match the ejector, and then dents or smudges also on the casing itself that match the ejector. Now, these are all called tool marks, and they match exactly to the weapon, like I have here.
There's a body. Our friend wasn't answering his phone. We just did a wellness check. We just came here, and he appears dead.
Okay.
There's blood. He's laying next to his bed, off of his bed, in his blood. I can't get closer to see more than that.
Okay, so you can tell he's obviously not breathing or anything?
Yeah.
Is it like kind of like puddle, like, you know, does he look like...
It doesn't look puddled. I can't look.
Okay, all right, I understand.
A source has come out and stated that Dr. Michael McKee right here worked a full shift on Monday, December 29th, 2025, and then had a cot reserved for him at the hospital to spend the night. This was the evening before, into the morning of the Tepe's double homicide. So essentially, Dr. Michael McKee had planned to stay overnight at the hospital instead of going home the night that he committed these crimes. And this may be part of the reason why authorities are saying that this was a premeditated, planned attack, because he was thinking things out.
Theories are like wildfire online. That is from @MattThibodeau at TikTok. And keep thinking, citizen sleuths, you are welcome here with all of your theories, be they crazy or that one's not that crazy, is it? Actually, that's a good theory. Was it premeditated? Obviously, he had hours long to drive. At this moment, tonight, extradition has been delayed. Is he a security risk? In the meantime, during our last live chat, during the airing of our program, a viewer noticed this. Do not discount any evidence as being insignificant. Let's see. Okay, watch him walk. He pulls to the right. He pulls to the right. One more time in the courtroom video. He pulls to the right when he walks. To the right, to the right, to the right. There he goes and stands. Goes to the right. Now, that's from WBNS 10 TV, our friends there. Now, let's look at the video. To the right. To the right. He pulls to the right on every step. Let me see that one more time. Okay, straight out to Randy Kessler, veteran trial lawyer, joining us out of the Atlanta jurisdiction at ksfamilylaw.com. Randy, thank you again for being with us tonight. Randy, I recall, I don't know if you remember it, because you were definitely in the courthouse during this trial, my first bank robbery case, armed robbery. Of course, at superior level, you don't usually get a bank robbery because FDIC, it's a federal case. But I got it, and I thought, wow, why am I getting to try a bank robbery? This is unusual. It's because it was a terrible case.
That's because it's Nancy Grace.
You couldn't identify the defendant. Could
that's
not,
why you got it.
Assigned by random, by the way. So it wasn't that. But you could not identify the defendant at all. He had on a hat, a wig, dark aviator sunglasses, a fake mustache, a fake beard. He was wearing a three-piece double-breasted suit, which as soon as he got out, he ripped it all off. Underneath, it was just basted up the back. Underneath, he had on shorts, a T-shirt, and he just got on a bike and pedaled off as the police arrived. You know what got him? The way he walked. Because he was slew-footed. He walked like a duck. Plus, he was dyslexic. And the bank robbery note said, don't touch the owl ram. This is a Roby. So that said, he walked with his feet like that. And he sadly took the stand. And he took the stand in front of the jury. You know, that lawyer could have put him on the stand while the jury was out of the room and not seen him walk. He could have been sitting up there when the jury came in. I was just praying they wouldn't do that. The jury looked over the rail and saw him walking slew-footed, just like the bank robber walked in. Feet just like this. Did you see this guy? Did you see Dr. McKee walking, pulling to the right every time?
Yeah. I mean, you never know what's going to tilt the jury or persuade the jury. Hopefully they've got a lot more evidence than just the way he walks, but it doesn't hurt to have that in there. And certainly, you know, video cameras being everywhere, video cameras being in the courtroom, this is helpful. It's all, you know, adding on to the prosecution's case. I represent a lot of men, controlling men, that my advice is don't go to court. You know why? Because then all of a sudden your wife is just as equal to you and the court will make you do something. Maybe not make you pay as much as you want. That's hard for a lot of powerful men and women to understand that the relationship they've been controlling is all of a sudden changed where they are no longer the superior in the relationship. And who knows if that's what clicked for him or triggered it, as we talked about earlier.
Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
Dave Mack joining us tonight, Crime Stories investigative reporter. Is it true that vascular surgeon Dr. McKee was arrested at Chick-fil-A?
He was, Nancy. The guy is just acting like there's nothing going on, just a regular day at the races, and he pops into Chick-fil-A to get his favorite lunch snack. That's where he was actually arrested, and the ATF was there on site, Nancy.
I wonder why the ATF arrested him. That's a whole nother can of worms. We know that the extradition procedure has been delayed. Apparently, a private company performs the extradition process. It's being contracted out, and they have a delay. I'm sure he's not in a hurry to get back. Randy Kessler joining us, trial lawyer. The arrogance. You know what this reminds me of? Scott Peterson. And I'll tell you why. When Lacey's DNA was matched to the body of her and her unborn child, Connor, officers came and they told Scott Peterson. They wanted to tell him in person, Kessler. They said, we have to inform you that we've done a DNA match and the bodies that washed ashore, it's Lacey and Connor. And do you know, within about 7 or 8 minutes, Scott Peterson asked the police to drive him through in and out. He wanted it animal style, which means a special sauce. He wanted a double-double with cheese, fries, and a shake. It certainly did not affect his appetite, did it? That no, he just learned Lacey was absolutely dead and he would never have the son Connor. Same thing here. What did he do? Do a double round through Chick-fil-A to get some extra Chick-fil-A sauce?
And right, that's your closing argument. You're going to make that your closing argument, ladies and gentlemen?
Yeah, part of it. You're darn right, it's part of my closing argument.
Chick-fil-A.
He gets the fungries.
He should starve.
You're right.
He should sit in a room and eat porridge and eat. He should sit there and eat TV trays, TV dinners, and do nothing but. But mourn. This was his ex-wife from years ago. He was eating.
He should go turn himself in.
Chick-fil-A is delicious.
He should turn himself in.
Okay, but that's nothing. But whether he was eating at Popeye's or Chick-fil-A or Church's Fried Chicken, what does that matter? He's a guy who's got a stomach.
I don't care where. I don't care where he ate. My point is, you know what? Dr. Bethany, I believe you could verbalize this to Kessler and maybe make some sense, get into that head. You explain the significance of this.
Well, I see it as congratulatory, self-congratulatory. So he's been obsessing all these years about getting rid of her. We call it catathymic homicide. That's when there's a compulsion to kill. And it creates a horrible tension internally. And when the criminal finally works up the courage to do it, they're quite relieved afterwards. They're very satisfied with themselves. He, as I said earlier, he triumphed over here. He got his way. Now his world is all in perfect order. It's not like somebody who commits vehicular homicide by mistake and afterwards they're rattled and they're shaken and they can't believe that they hit somebody. This guy is quite happy. So I think this is his happy meal. You know, he's dancing on her grave.
Dave Mack, Crime Stories investigative reporter, why did the ATF arrest him?
It came down to a lie. Dr. Michael McKee lied on a federal form when he purchased a handgun in Nevada. He provided a false residency form of information, and that immediately triggered the federal jurisdiction for firearm violations alongside the state murder charges. So the ATF was brought in because of the lie about where he was living when he filed for that gun.
Okay. Did serious lawsuits play into triggering Dr. McKee? Not that motive is necessary. Listen.
12 weeks before he's accused of murder, McKee is sued for malpractice by a Nevada man. McKee allegedly overseen when an 8.6-inch catheter shard breaks off in the patient's leg. The patient's lawyer spends over a month trying to track down McKee to serve papers and has no luck. The process server claims a co-worker of McKee says he just disappeared.
McKee leaves Vegas after the malpractice lawsuit, taking a job at OSF St. Anthony Medical Center, Rockford, Illinois, purchasing a $400,000 penthouse apartment in Chicago last July. The complaint alleges the failure of McKee caused the catheter to shear, leaving an 8.6-inch portion of the device in the plaintiff's body. McKee allegedly breached the standard of care, including lower extremity bleeding, edema, pain, discoloration, disfigurement, and other injuries.
He evaded getting served. He hightailed it. Even a process server couldn't find him.
McKee was able to evade a malpractice lawsuit for months as a process server makes nearly a dozen failed attempts to serve McKee with the lawsuit. Nevada lawyer Dan Laird files the suit, but serving McKee was nearly impossible as the surgery group he worked for gave the attorney a fake address, and the phone number issued with the state medical board for McKee is a fax machine.
What did Dr. Caravella say?
He said he has no idea where Dr. Michael McKee is now, said he just disappeared.
Wow. So McKee was a ghost. That's from WSYX. And more. Listen to this. A guy loses his testicle.
A prison inmate in Nevada claims McKee caused him to have his left testicle removed. The plaintiff alleges he suffered a work-related injury while incarcerated, causing pain and swelling in his left testicle. McKee was part of a medical review panel that approved the inmate's medical care, resulting in a surgeon with limited experience to be used for the surgery. After a year of pain, repeated procedures to drain fluid, a proper corrective surgery was performed, but the delay in treatment resulted in the permanent removal of the inmate's left testicle.
Repeated draining of your testicle? Okay, Dr. Thomas Coyne, were these lawsuits enough to trigger him into doing something horrible, like a double murder, thinking, she caused all of this strife in my life, it's all her fault, blah, blah, blah. A shard of a catheter left in your leg, a surgical procedure to amputate your testicle? I guess he was under stress. How do you end up with a catheter shard stuck in your leg, and why do you have your testicle cut off?
Well, I mean, so if you are performing a surgery on someone, obviously, especially a vascular surgery, where you are instrumenting or entering into or repairing a blood vessel, oftentimes that you may insert a catheter to maintain the patency or keep that vessel open while you're operating on it. I don't know how in this particular case this occurred, but it's possible that a shard of that catheter was dislodged during surgery, was accidentally cut off and left in, or just simply left in accidentally rather than being removed when the surgery was complete. And that if that catheter is left in place, it could actually block the normal blood flow within that vessel, causing ischemia, as we say, or lack of blood flow to the testicle, which could cause that testicle to die. It can be very
painful. There are two different cases, Dr. Coyne. There's the one case with the catheter shard left in the leg. Then there's the other case of the inmate who has his testicle amputated.
Oh, that, I don't know. I don't know how that process happened. But the catheter, I mean, listen, there's been plenty of cases throughout, my time during training where there's been instruments left in patients, wrong size operated on, small little cloth pieces left inside a body during a surgery. So it does happen. And generally it's just, carelessness. You're worried too much about closing or a bleeding area and you leave a catheter in place. And so that's probably what happened in that instance. As to the testicle incident, certainly testicular torsion can happen in males. I don't know what went wrong there.
I don't want to think about what went wrong there, but I know this, Randy Kessler. When I graduated from law school, I never thought that I would put testicle amputated in the same sentence. You just never know, right?
There's a lot there that we're on air and I can't talk about, but Nancy, you were tough as a prosecutor, and that's, I'll leave it at that.
Guys, the state is still building its case. If you know or think you know anything about this case, if you saw something, heard something, please call 614-645-2228. Repeat, 614-645-2228.
Nancy Grace signing off. Goodbye, friend.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.